Blog Talk Radio.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. You ain't gonna be in there. But 51% of your prison will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Blacks won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourself up. I told that 5-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economics. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control business and industry, and put that pulls in your money, and hold that money, and practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 to 13 times for a lease. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folk got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money. Major corporations who got the money. That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control and you take your money on the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with the politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor then is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor and you control the court system and the police department. Then the fourth floor then is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk only control less than 0.035% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about 75 or 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You got about one black TV station. So you can't communicate with your people. You can't inform your people. You can't do anything. You can have Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of the guys talking about racism all day long and bad mouthing you. And O'Reilly, they can call black folk all kind of names all day long. What are you going to do? You can't respond. You can't even communicate with your own people because you don't have an economic base. 51% of all the prisons in the United States are black people. You only make up 12% of the population. That's no accident. It's because you don't control the economics and the politics. And they're going to go after the weakest people they can get their hands on to incarcerate them. That's the black folk. And what are you going to do in response to them when they over-incarcerate you? You're going to go out and have a march, a demonstration. We're going to march. March for what? Who cares? Marching never changed anything.
We'll be right back.
okay? I remember, like, when we were at the hospital, like, very clearly. We waited there for a while, and then my dad came out and he's like, your brother's here. I got to see him from the glass. I remember seeing other kids that were Tor's age, and they were like crawling and walking, and I was like, so when is Tor gonna start walking and talking? They're like, probably you won't be able to walk and talk. I must have been at around like 4 or 5 years old when I realized that things were a little different. And down the name is Stefan Alexis, 24 years old.
This is a team effort. There we go. Tickles.
I'm a young caregiver. I take care of my younger sibling, Torrance. He is 21 years old and he has cerebral palsy. He's not verbal. He doesn't really have any balance. He's completely dependent.
Wow. You want to go to bed? You wanna go to bed?
It's not an easy job. He needs you for everything. So you have to be taking care of him 24/7. I think Tor sees the world simpler than we see it. So I feel like he appreciates the things that we take for granted. We think he sees the world in lights and shapes.
Okay, buddy.
A year ago when Tor turned 21, he graduated from high school and all the services stopped. So when that happened, we didn't have any support during the day.
You're doing well.
And all the work kind of fell on my dad.
Yeah, he should be hungry though.
So that's when I was like, okay, I have to help. Mom's working full time, has her hands full, taking care of the house too, so I'm here. Even though I wasn't like feeling great, it's, you make sacrifices for your family. When people think about a caregiver, they generally think about a female. It's a very easy assumption to make and a very easy picture to paint. Watching my dad taking care of Tor has impacted me in a pretty significant way because he's shown me the other side of masculinity. He teaches me how you're supposed to be attentive to certain things and how you're supposed to like take care of your family.
So I'm picking up, okay, passata sauce, pepperoni, spinach, eggs. I'll be back.
When you're taking care of a family member, the house revolves around that family member. So you kind of have to coordinate who's going to stay and who's going to go out because everything's, it's like an orchestra. So you have to kind of get everything in a certain balance.
Why don't you go to bed, Torrance?
There's so many little intricate details that go not into like just everyday life, but into a life where you're taking care of someone else.
Tells me so.
love Tora to death. We love him unconditionally. We would do anything for him, of course. But any kind of long, continuous strain has an impact on you mentally. My friends are aiming towards like their career, and they're chasing like their dreams and all that. Having to put my goals and aspirations on the back burner can be really frustrating. I can't do this forever. It's a tough place to be in, because, like, what do I pay? Like, how do I choose? What will happen, like, if I'm not there to kind of relieve the pressure? Everyone's getting older and the needs are going up, and it's breaking the balance. He just had a really bad seizure.
He did?
Okay.
Let me come on, give you a hand.
If I can't be here, like, physically to help, I need to find another way to help out. Easy ignoring these people because there's no voice. Because the people that have the voice are too tired to like raise their voices. They're already exhausted from the day to day, and they don't have the energy to go out and protest. Try and like fight the government and like lobby and do all this crazy stuff, because like the day-to-day never really stops. You don't have the energy because you're just trying to make it day-to-day.
Okay, that audit. All right, That audio sense. Okay, today's It's My House is titled Caregiver in Healthcare Literacy, 619-768-2945. And last night, Sunday night, we introduced our new podcast, which we'll do on Sunday evenings, titled, the running title, what did we run last night? Healthcare Distinctions. We might, matter of fact, today's podcast might be titled, we might go with today's title as a regular title, Caregiver in Healthcare Literacy. What inspired this particular podcast yesterday, and then, like I said, we were introducing it because we, our listenership is mostly Monday through Friday, is my mother made transition this past Saturday, like it, around 12:58 a.m. and Eastern Standard Time. And she was a registered nurse. That was her primary career. And she worked a number of years in the emergency room, administering anesthesia. And in that emergency room, you see a whole lot. if you go to our Facebook page, which is Housemakers Social Network, Housemakers Social Network, at the top of that page, you'll see I posted a picture of it. But now, this podcast inspired by her, and we're also going to talk about on a continual, because we were already setting up, organizing tiny house villages and tiny houses running on solar. At the core of the communities that we set up offline will center around health care, because there's some distinctions of it. So that's part of my way of honoring her life, or celebrating her life. Now, let's get to some literacy here. And this is basic, because although she was a registered nurse for over 50 years, and she was a caregiver too after she retired. She did foster care. I mean, she had a pretty good resume, but she didn't know everything, as nobody does, particularly when it comes to caregiving and healthcare literacy. And that's where we're going to pick up. Now, the official cause of her death was heart attack. All right, so if you go to the hospital for us or whatever, heart attack. But what triggered the heart attack? All right, well, let's back up 2 days before that. And doctor calls me early Thursday morning and tells me that she has a urinary tract infection, she has pneumonia, and she has, and after a little bit of conversation, he finally told me, and she has sepsis, S-E-P-S-I-S. And he said she weighed 110 pounds. That's the only part that I don't buy, because I was with her when she went to the emergency room. I went there the next day, and I was with her hours before she passed away. My mother was 5'11", and with large, I just didn't see. I know she lost over 100 pounds, but she used to weigh more than me. I weigh about 225, 230. She used to weigh 250, so I put her around 2. Anyway, but that's what it is. So now it was, so she had three things going on: urinary tract infection and bed sores. Okay. The sepsis and what he said is pneumonia. So I went and looked up, I already knew about tract infections because she had one some years ago. I went to the health food store, asked the clerks what's good for a urinary tract infection, took it back to the house, urinary tract infection cleared in a day. That and garlic. All right, and that's on her. So I was also, and I know she wasn't drinking enough on a consistent basis, because if you don't drink enough water or enough fluids, non-toxic fluids, that includes coffee, because coffee is very acidic. Pneumonia. So me and her caregiver were trying to figure out, how did she get pneumonia? Because me and the caregiver were all right. The dogs were all right. Nobody that came a bit. Everybody, all the caregiver, clean bill of health. So then I looked up pneumonia, and I've even had it, but I looked it up, and then I discovered that there were, at least on that particular day, I discovered that there were three distinctions of pneumonia: communal pneumonia, viral pneumonia, bacterial pneumonia. Now, there's another distinction I found out, but that was about 24 hours ago. I'll tell you about that in a moment. So communal pneumonia, you can pick that being in a community. If you're in a community of a jail or a prison, that's a community, or it can be a residential community, I mean a commune, or it can be a hospital. Heard of people going to the hospital with no pneumonia? I had an aunt who lived to be my mother's big sister. She passed away at 104 last September. She had choked on some kind of food, and kids got it out of her throat. But then they took her to the hospital, and she contracted the pneumonia at the hospital. What distinction of pneumonia did she get? Communal pneumonia. So I'm figuring, and then there's bacterial pneumonia. So I'm figuring, well, maybe the caregivers didn't clean her properly and bathe her properly, you know, thus, you know, the pressure sore is also known as bed sores. I'm thinking that. So I called a friend of mine who's a traveling nurse that I met a couple of years at a tiny house summer camp. And I explained, you know, that my mother had been bedridden for 2 years and how she ate food and all this other stuff. And then she said, it sounds like your mother has, and here's where the fourth distinction of pneumonia's come in. There might be more, but this is what I know as of today. And none of my mother's caregivers knew, and my mother didn't know, because I would often ask her, what can I do? Who can I go to? And I called some of her retired colleagues. None of them gave any useful information other than get her out of the bed and into a wheelchair. But, and let me put some distinctions out here, because this goes along with this preventative health care. This is what you can do on your own. That's one distinction. And we'll have many podcasts on that. Number two, there's maintenance health care. And number three, there's about seven distinctions, but I'm only going to put out three today. Curative health care. Once you went up in a situation like my mother was in, what is the curative health care that can take place? And more than likely, you might not go to a hospital. A hospital is a whole nother animal. I'm not knocking the hospital, but you had to know what lane to drive in to give the proper care. All right. Now, the fourth distinction of pneumonia that I found out from my friend Kelly, who we're going to have on. She's been on here before, but we were talking about tiny houses then. We're going to have her come back and talk about traveling nurses, nursing in general, caregiving, and the different type of things we should know, but we don't know. And this is caregiving, people, not medicine. Caregiving. Basic health care, not medicine. That's a different lane. All right? So we have to become aware of the landscape out here. Now, aspiration pneumonia. I had to look at the pronounce it right. Kelly said more than likely my mother had aspiration pneumonia. Now, how did she come up with that? Well, my mother had a bad reaction to a steroid called prednisone, which she had absolutely no business taking, but that's going to be another podcast. She had a reaction to it, and then she survived it, and she was paranoid of falling. Even before that happened, she was a little paranoid, but she was still walking on her own, and occasionally if she went out, she would use a walker. And then when you didn't mention nothing about the walker, she was solo, didn't need a cane walker, none of that. But after she took the prednisone, she became paranoid that, you know, she couldn't keep her balance. So she got in the bed. I never got out of that bed for 2 years. And anyway, she was so paranoid of even falling out of the bed, she was eating her meals laying down. She was drinking her fluids laying down. And the body is not designed to ingest food that way, digest food that way. Is just, and I preached to the cows came home on that one. But there wasn't much improvement on that. And I bought everything for her to sit in bed and eat properly, you know, comfortably sitting, I mean, you know, with a bed cushion and wedges and a nice breakfast table and whatnot. But you give that to her in some kind of way, she pushed away, she just lay on her back, eat food and drink food, and that's one of the ways you can get aspirational pneumonia. Because with aspirational pneumonia, some of your food that you're eating and the drink that you're drinking can go into your lungs. I'm thinking, I wonder how it took 2 years. I mean, whatever. But so inflammation, I mean, and any type of pneumonia is inflammation. And then here's a combination of things. So when you're laying on your back that way and you're eating food that way and the food goes, food and liquids are not supposed to go into your lungs, you're inflaming your lung system. That's what pneumonia is. It's inflammation. Something, your lungs are inflamed. Okay. You're not drinking enough water. Urinary tract becomes inflamed. Same shit, different name. It's all inflammation. Then when you're laying in bed, day after day, your body, your muscles are starting to atrophy away. You're losing your confidence, and in every cell in your body, matter of fact, eat something or drink something, and it goes through our digestive tract. It comes out the other end as urine waste, urine and feces, which is, you know, waste, toxic. The body rejects it after it gets what it needs. Well, every cell in the body takes in nutrients, and it lets out waste. So if you're not moving, and this waste has nowhere to escape, and then it can get into your bloodstream, then you can get a blood infection, you got sepsis. You're basically poisoning yourself by not moving. And then eventually, it took 2.5 years to all of it to catch up, you transition out of this world. And here was she was good at what she did. She was professional. And we always had to keep on learning, but apparently she didn't know much or anything about caregiver literacy, because sometimes you're going to have to communicate to people on how you need to be cared for. And healthcare literacy as well. All right, like I said, she had a good run, but she would be living today, in my opinion, had she been drinking enough water to moving. Now, this is where we come to preventative healthcare. See, I'm not saying any one of these are a silver bullet, but preventative healthcare is drinking enough fluids, which a formula is take half of your body weight, divide it in two, and put it into ounces. And then you got to drink that a day. For me, it's about 4 liters a day minimum in a moderate climate. If I go to a tropical climate, I've got to double that. Now, I'm 6'8". 225 to 230 pounds. All right. But if you're 5'8", You don't need to drink 4 liters of water in a moderate climate. All right. So whatever your body weight is, divide it by 2, and that's the amount of ounces, and you just convert ounces into liters. For most people, it's going to be 2. Some people, it's going to be 3 liters. Some people, it's going to be 4 liters, like for me. Some people, depending on your weight, if you weigh 300 or 400 pounds, you might have to take in 5-6 liters a day. That's all part of preventative. That's just one little small part of preventative health care. There are other things like, you know, she didn't move. Limited movement when you're in that bed like that. Just walking. I have a friend of mine passed away 2 years ago at 58. He weighed maybe 325, 350, I'm guessing. Or definitely 325. And but not as active as he should have been, really. Sort of a couch potato, like behind the computer. Second week of school, because he was an educator, died on a school field trip. Now, his mother, who is late 80s, early 90s, walks 2 miles a day, 7 days a week, and plays golf every Saturday with his brother. You got to move. To help him, we're going to do some podcasts, maybe do it tomorrow or later this week, but definitely on Sunday night on, because, you know, you have an excretory system too. You know, you got a circulatory system, skeletal system, respiratory system. Well, you definitely got an excretory system. We're going to go down all the ways that your body excretes waste. It's just not through sweat or urine, or poop. But we'll go through the excretory system, and we might do it tomorrow. So because if your body does not properly eliminate, you're basically poisoning yourself. And the body's going to communicate to you, because we're going to get to that, how your body talks to you. Because your body does talk to you through pain, through discomfort. It even talks to you through loss of appetite. I got a friend of mine, we're going to have him on. He'll break that down. With a loss of appetite, your body is saying, look, I got enough in. Although, let's say you haven't even eaten in 2, 3, 4, 5 days. And we can't get them to eat. Why? Because they're full of waste. Get rid of the waste. Their appetite will come back voraciously. Caregivers should know this. Every family member should know this. Next thing, randomly, you need a health plan. This is part of curative health care. If your caregiver doesn't suggest it, then you need to sit down with that caregiver and have a clear cut. First thing, you need to find out what her literacies are when it comes to caregiving and healthcare. What strategy are we going to use? Because more than likely, if it's a curative healthcare strategy, you know, there's nothing, like I said, we're going to have, so that's why we had to dedicate a separate podcast on Sunday night, and more than likely that's going to become a channel of its own, where we're pumping out information Monday through Friday. And the tiny house villages that we're setting up, at its core, the glue of it, will revolve around health care literacy. Because that's the one thing that's one of the one things that connect us all. You can be a rocket scientist. You can be a bricklayer. You can be president of the United States. You can be a billionaire. But if you don't, your real health is your wealth. You can't do anything unless you're in decent health. That's the one common denominator. Forget about race. Forget about color. Good health is your wealth. That's where it's at. All right? So, matter of fact, this might even be healthcare week. Matter of fact, you know what? This week, in honor of my mother, is caregiver and healthcare literacy week here on His Miles, because it's so much. And every member, in my opinion, every member of your household should be up on the basics of caregiving and healthcare. So every day this week, we're going to cover some aspect and bring in other people to give aspects. I mean, we'll bring in people. You'll hear people that have had open heart surgery and survived it, heart transplant survived it, pneumonia, all kind of stuff. Anyway, let's go back to, because I got more audio, so let's play them on caregiving literacy and healthcare literacy.
Hello, everyone. My name is Cedric, and I'm an at-home caregiver for my father, who has had Alzheimer's now for a little over 15 years. Today, I want to do a quick video talking about aspirating pneumonia, which is a deadly illness but has very minor symptoms, very common symptoms, symptoms like coughing, symptoms like a slight fever, symptoms like a gurgling sound that you may interpret as phlegm in the throat. I want to talk to you today about this because about 2 to 3 months ago, my dad developed aspirating pneumonia. Now, I had never heard of aspirating pneumonia. And when he developed this, I had no idea of what the symptoms were. About 2 to 3 months ago, my dad developed a very common cough. There was nothing severe about this cough. It was just a normal cough. And most of us, when we have normal coughs, we treat it with cough syrup. And that's what I did. I treated it with cough syrup. The next day, my dad started developing a slight fever. The fever wasn't very high, but it was just a slight fever. And I treated the fever with a little Tylenol, because that's what most people do, not thinking that it was something more severe. Now, the next day, after me knowing this, I started paying more attention to my dad's cough. And what struck me in a pattern was that when I was feeding him, it seemed like each meal that I fed him, his cough got a little worse. And that's what struck me as odd and made me call the nurse in. Once I told the nurse about the symptoms that he was having, that he was coughing when I was feeding him, and that he was running a slight fever, she knew those symptoms were something that may be dealing with aspirating pneumonia. And so she had us to call the ambulance and to get him to the hospital. Once we got him to the hospital and they ran a few tests on him, come to find out he did have aspirating pneumonia. Now, what this was the feeding that I was doing, that I was giving him, the food and the liquids that I was giving him, was spilling over into his lungs and filling his lungs up. And we all know what will happen if your lungs fill up. You can't get air, and therefore you will suffocate or you will drown yourself to death. So, in other words, if I had not taken action and getting him to the hospital, unknowingly, I could have been feeding and giving liquids to my daddy and actually causing death on him. The symptoms are so minor until you just have no idea that it's something as deadly as aspirating pneumonia. So what I wanted to do, I wanted to take this time out to, for all at-home caregivers who doesn't have a medical background, that if someone in your family that's elderly or has Alzheimer's and can't feed themselves, and they start having a slight cough when you're feeding them, they're getting feverish, or they're having, and they're having this little gurgly sound as though they're having watery sound in their throat, like they need to cough up something. It could be that their lungs are filling up and they're not getting enough oxygen in their lungs, and they are actually drowning, or they are actually suffocating, if you will. So if you have symptoms like that, do not take it for granted. Call a nurse in, get them to the emergency center, because it's, these symptoms are so minor until you'll be giving them Tylenol, you'll be giving them cough syrup, when it's really not a cough, and the fever is really not coming from the cough, but it's coming from some deep within them. So I want to take a quick video. I want to take time out and make this quick video, because this happened to me, and it just, by the grace of God, that I started noticing that he was coughing more regular when I was feeding him, and know that there was something that was really uncommon. And it prompted me to call the nurse in. So if you have someone in your home and you're taking care of them, and they are giving you a cough, and really if they are having this gurgling sound like it's phlegm, but yet when they cough that they are not coughing up anything, or even if they cough up a little bit, it's more like the food that you are just giving them, but yet they will continue to have this gurgling sound in them, then 9 times out of 10, they probably have aspirating pneumonia. So my recommendation would be to get them to the hospital as fast as you can. I hope this video helped. I have a link to my website down at the bottom that I'm actually writing on things that have occurred to me that I'm hoping that will help others out. Thank you for listening to this video, and I will see you on the next video. Thank you.
Now, like I said earlier, the cause, the official cause of death with my mother, according from the direct, when I asked, heart attack. But like I said, you have to look at, and this is what we call this caregiver literacy and healthcare literacy. What triggered the heart attack? Now, the first doctor told me that she had pneumonia, but they didn't say what distinction of pneumonia. So putting things together, more than likely she had aspirational pneumonia, which it can be deadly because it can trigger a heart attack. So I'm looking at that was one of the root causes. And a care, and I'm looking, because I got a higher bar now with caregivers and medical professionals. They need to be just like him. He picked up, you got to know when to call the proper nurse or the proper caregiver, and if they have to go to the emergency room, you know, the right call, or what can you do? So, like I said, in the case, his case, the feeding of the Tylenol and the cough syrup only exacerbates the situation, particularly that stuff might be going into the lungs. All right, which just compounds it. But those things, like I say, can trigger respiratory failure or heart failure.
So the question I'm going to address today is, how can I prevent aspiration pneumonia? Well, this is really worth addressing. As you may have heard, aspiration pneumonia is the number one cause of death in all people with any form of a neurodegenerative disease. So that can feel a bit looming and a bit heavy, but don't be afraid. Make sure you have a speech therapist on your team that can help you to address any problems that you might be having with swallowing. So, let's go to that.
I'm going to play that over because this audio. In your health plan or your healing plan, you need to have the proper team members on it. I'm going to play this thing, but like I say, this is regarding the sepsis. And I've heard a speech therapist before, but I never related it that they would be involved in this aspect of caregiving in healthcare, a speech therapist. And I never even heard of the concept of measuring your swallow. Once again, aspirational pneumonia. Your swallow ain't right. Your swallow ain't right, food goes in the wrong direction, and it can be deadly and trigger a heart attack or respiratory failure.
So the question I'm going to address today is, how can I prevent aspiration pneumonia? Well, this is really worth addressing. As you may have heard, aspiration pneumonia is the number one cause of death in all people with any form of a neurodegenerative disease. So that can feel a bit looming and a bit heavy, but don't be afraid. Make sure you have a speech therapist on your team that can help you to address any problems that you might be having with swallowing. So let's go to that speech therapist and get your swallow assessed. Depending on the problem that you're having, you may just need to be seen in the speech therapist's office, or she may come to your home to do the assessment. But you may also likely need to go into a radiology department and have an X-ray of your swallow performed. It may be called a video fluoroscopic swallow study, or it could be called a modified barium swallow study. These are both X-rays, and they're really the same thing. I hope to have a future video where I can show you and describe to you exactly what happens when you have that study done. It's a pretty simple procedure and quite quick. All right, so once the swallow is assessed, we'll develop a plan for how to treat whatever your difficulty is. I want to point out that right here and now, I can't give you any hard and pat, here's the exercises you need to do to make your swallow better. You have to have your swallow assessed because there are many different muscle groups involved in swallowing. So we need to identify where's the problem for you, and then which exercises do I need to do to make my swallow better. So a speech therapist will work on these exercises that are weak. I want to make you aware that there's a modality that some of us are trained in and that you may have applied when you are doing your swallow exercises or eating during therapy. It's called neuromuscular electrical stimulation. You might hear it also called, shortened form, vital stim. It's where we apply electrodes to the throat, or possibly we would apply it to the outside of your cheeks if we're working on this area more. But we apply them on the outside of your throat and we send an impulse, an electrical stimulation to the muscles to retrain them to do a full contraction and therefore make them stronger again. Now, keep in mind that with Parkinson's, I understand that there can be a sensory component to the disease. And so for some of my folks, I'll find that they're a bit hypersensitive to this treatment. But that doesn't mean we can't do it. What I do is I just start with a lower current of an electrical impulse, and I work slowly and gradually to increase that current so that your body can adapt to what that sensation is and no longer be hypersensitive to it. Now, it might take me 3 or 4 sessions to get to what we call a therapeutic level. But while that might be kind of the bad news, I've got some really great news for you. I find that with my Parkinson's folks, once I do reach that therapeutic level, it doesn't take nearly as many sessions as it may some of my non-Parkinson's patients. Once we remind that muscle what a full contraction is, it's so happy to do it that it just picks it right up. So, a little bit of the tricky news, some of the really great news. Here's a little bit of that iffy news. So once I've done that treatment, for most folks, my non-Parkinson's folks, we may only need to do it every 3 years. The therapy holds that long. With Parkinson's, I can't really predict that. In 6 months, I may need to come back and do a little bit of a tune-up, or I may never need to come back. So it just depends on your own individual situation. But I'm here for you, so come back and see me. All right. So once we have tried to improve your swallow, we may need to work on strategies to compensate for what we can't fully fix. And that may include altering the way or your positioning or maybe the food textures that you have. What I'm going to say here is that when you're working with your speech therapist, I want you to be wary of blanket statements that I've heard out in the community, which are things like, people with Parkinson's shouldn't use straws, or spit that gum out, you might choke on it. All right, that just doesn't make any sense. Now, what it takes is a speech therapist to come in and assess, all right, what's the best way for you to swallow? For some folks, it is using a straw. For other people, the water bottle even works great. And for some folks, I'll use more of a wide mouth, maybe a heavier glass if you're struggling with some tremors. But it will really help to have a speech therapist determine what's best for you. So to answer the question, what we work on is we work to strengthen the system, compensate if need be, modify textures if need be. And another important part of the equation is to make sure you have a really good oral hygiene program. That's a really important way to prevent aspiration pneumonia. Our studies show that it's not always the food and liquid that causes the pneumonia, but it's the bad bacteria that is in your own mouth and in your saliva that then gets aspirated into the lungs and fosters and grows that pneumonia. So in a future video, I want to go over with you what's a really good basic oral hygiene program. But as with anything, there's no one size fits all. You may need to talk with your speech therapist and your occupational therapist to develop a really good program for you. So thanks for joining me today, and bon appetit!
I don't know about you, but that was a very enlightening one. The few caregivers that I've come across don't know anything about what you just heard in that audio. Next one, we're going to get some information on sepsis.
Sepsis refers to the effects throughout the body, the systemic effects of infection that is put some type of toxic products into the bloodstream. Many infections could cause it, not all. Most common would be bacterial infections, but one can have a picture of sepsis with other types of bugs also. Sepsis can affect almost any organ system of the body. The most common ones would be respiratory system with shortness of breath or fluid leaking out into the lungs. The kidneys can be affected. The GI tract can affect the motility of the gastrointestinal tract. Neurologic system, one could have confusion or delirium. And really almost any other system of the body. The liver, for example, could be impaired also. Anyone could develop sepsis, even with an intact immune system. Patients on chemotherapy or other immune-suppressing drugs are much more at risk for infections that could spread throughout the body. Surgical patients may be at risk, not necessarily so. It may be that there's an exposure related to the surgery. The way sepsis is defined in its stages is beginning with what's called a systemic inflammatory response. And those signs are nonspecific, but they do make one think about infection, the most common of which is fever. Other signs that one would notice are rapid heart rate, rapid shallow breathing, and then other laboratory tests such as a high white cell count. Now, if those things occur and one thinks there might be an infection, there are some symptoms of the urinary tract or cough with sputum production or an open sore, as you said, then you have a presumed source for infection and these findings that suggest sepsis could be developing. Taking the temperature objectively with a real measurement is important because it gives a good assessment of how severe this might be. In terms of managing it and doing something, probably the single most important thing is to try to maintain fluid intake, because the findings, the damage from sepsis probably begins with loss of volume within the body, loss of fluids. And if one's not able to keep down fluids, then that can make the findings and the damage from sepsis much worse. Let's say, for example, one feels some nasal congestion, an achy, like a cold or upper respiratory illness they've had many times before, and a low-grade temperature of 99 or 100 degrees Fahrenheit. And otherwise, they're up and around and they're able to drink fluids. That would not call for going to the emergency department. But if one was not able to take fluids, became more sleepy and lethargic, and was lying down all day, and starting to look quite ill or appearing confused, then that should definitely be seen. So the first steps are really to try to make an accurate diagnosis so that cultures from the blood and any other relevant parts of the body, urinary tract or sputum cultures, are obtained, but especially blood cultures, because if you can identify an organism that's in the blood, that helps to guide the specific treatment. Fluids are administered, and based on what the presumed source of infection might be, antibiotics are usually started right away. Sepsis refers to the signs of inflammation in the presence of presumed infection. Severe sepsis means you've got that and signs of organ damage, lung injury, impaired kidney function, impaired liver function. Septic shock means you have all of those findings of severe sepsis, but now you've given initial resuscitation of fluid and there's still low blood pressure, poor urine output, breathing troubles. There's still signs of ongoing sepsis despite the initial resuscitation. Now that's septic shock. That has an associated risk of death in the hospital of about 20 to 30% most of the time.
All right, now we're going at, like, say, because sepsis, we can, once again, we're going to go to the root cause of it, and that's why we have the new Sunday night podcast, which will probably end up being a regular daily channel. On caregiver literacy and healthcare literacy, and be at the center core of the health villages, health/tiny health villages that we're tonight, but this week, all this week. So, let me see. That's about it for me today on audio. On that note, everyone have a good health. Drink your once away. Before I go, drink your body weight ounces today and move. On that note, have a good rest of the day.